Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. And Nick, we are coming off of, no doubt, the wildest weekend of college lacrosse that we saw so far in 2022. Did the season just get turned on its head, or did it really just get started? I'm going to dive into some sports cliches, but before I do, what just happened? What did we see?
If I was one of those people, I would say that Venus is in retrograde, but I'm not. But my goodness, weekends like this, are why you love sports, but almost like refreshing. So to answer your question, the season just got turned on its head completely. And I know WrestleMania just happened. Shout out Larkin Kemp. But this season just got RKO'd off the top turnbuckle, both for good and bad purposes that we will dive into. But the season did not just start. Teams are, you know, with what happened and what we'll talk about, teams are going to miss the playoffs because of this weekend, and they're not the teams that you expect to be missing playoffs very regularly. So what do you think? Just started or turned on its head?
So the only reason I frame it as just started is because of the cliche, a series doesn't start until the road team wins. And last week I talked about how what this season needed, because I think 2022 has been pretty good. But it's lacked in drama, and I think the reason is because Maryland and Virginia looked pretty much unbeatable until they played each other, at which point Maryland looked unbeatable. So last week I wrote that what this season needs is Maryland to get upset. And, you know, who better than Michigan, who has, to my knowledge, never beaten them and almost had them in, 2016 or something like that. It was a snowy day, I remember. Maybe it was 2015. Either way, Michigan did not beat Maryland this weekend. That is not something that we are going to talk about. That being said, Virginia did lose to Richmond. We are recording this at 9:30 on Sunday, Eastern time. Rutgers just beat Hopkins 12-7 on Big Ten Sunday Night Lacrosse in a game that we're not going to talk about, because if you watch the second half of it, you're probably asleep right now.
True. And there are just other good games. There just really are.
So let's start with the Richmond Spiders 17, the Virginia Cavaliers 13. So an in-state rivalry that has been great. In their first season, Richmond had Virginia on the ropes and lost by one. And when I say their first, I mean the inaugural season of the campaign of the program. This game was really flowing the Cavaliers' way until about 2 minutes left in the first quarter, when Petey LaSala, who had won 9 of the first 10 faceoffs of the game, got hurt, left the game, did not return. I believe he was spotted in a sling on the sideline as a result of a push that drew a penalty in that faceoff, that 10th faceoff of the game. After which, you can't really blame the faceoff production for the outcome, because the teams were basically 50-50 from that point going forward. But the Richmond offense clearly was able to find a rhythm, and you just had incredible production from guys like Dalton Young, who finished with 4 goals and 3 assists. Ryan Lanchberry had 4-1. Ryan Dunn had 3-2. And then for the Spiders, goalie Zach Vieg had 16 saves. It was an incredible performance from Richmond, and it absolutely turned the season on its head.
This is the one that has me worried, that all these talking points that we've had about the ACC and everything like that is correct, in the sense that the ACC has officially crumbled. I'm putting them officially on crumble notice, and that notice has gone and fully jumped the ship. I don't really know what else to say. I really don't know what else to say, because exactly like you called it out, someone losing a faceoff and then the faceoff going 50% should not have that big of an impact on the game. And this is almost irrelevant at this point, but I remember when I was coaching at Air Force, Richmond was far and away the scariest team. And I think they're sneaky one of those teams. And when we talk about Jacksonville High Point, the trajectory of Richmond, This is going to be a game that they use. They have beautiful facilities. It's in a really cool area of the country. From what I recall, they were a little loose. They could kind of, you know, scum it up a little bit, maybe talk a little bit more shit than some of the other more buttoned up teams. Like, if I'm a recruit and I watch this game, there's a serious chance that this is a game that has Richmond on an accelerated path to success, more so than they're on currently, and could very well see good ramifications from this game 3 to 4 years down the line with the ACC crumbling and with teams like Richmond cherry-picking wins off of Virginia. Now, maybe that's a little bit too, you know,
it's not
aggressive.
It's
in a prediction,
not.
But
dude, it's not.
I don't
because
so.
Listen to these stats. Virginia had won 73 straight games against other colleges located in the state of Virginia. The last time they lost to a team in Virginia was Washington and Lee, the Generals, in 1977. I'm pretty sure that's before the General Lee, the TV show Car, existed. I mean, out of all of the things it means to me, we need to get Virginia Tech, VCU, William & Mary, George Mason. They all need to add men's lacrosse because we can't have the Cavaliers, the Wahoos, going 73 straight games without losing to an in-state opponent. Like, we need Butler to bring back their program and Valparaiso and Indiana University to start men's lacrosse so that Notre Dame's in-state record or whatever can be challenged. But that's Indiana. That is not the state of Virginia, which is essentially at this point a lacrosse hotbed.
I mean, maybe first off, who pulled that stat? That's an incredible stat.
Correct. I don't know who to give credit to. I would assume if I'm the Richmond SID, I've probably known that for 8 years. You know what I mean? I've just been waiting to be the team. I was born in 1984. This streak was 11 years older than me, and I am old balls.
Jeez. And again, let me just derail the conversation. If you ask me what state, you know, that has multiple Division I teams has the longest winning record, I probably could have come to the conclusion that it was Virginia. I really don't think I would have gotten close to, the last time an in-state team was 77. That is historically bad. And again,
can you name one thing that happened in
1977? I was gonna say something that we would have to edit out. It would deal with my parents.
Oh, okay, got it.
But even then, like, no, I can't name some. Hold on, let me just things that happened in 1977. The last time this happened, Star Wars opened up in cinema. Are you kidding me? Elvis Presley died and NASA had Roman Polanski. Okay, maybe we don't play that game live, but no. First off, we need to find who to give credit to. That's an unbelievable stat, and I wouldn't be surprised if those kids from STAB and some of those, you know, high-profile Virginia schools were taking notes and and if I'm Virginia, I'm shitting my pants.
So last week, Patrick talked to us about conference RPI. To your point, this does not help the ACC.
Not only does it not help the ACC, we needed to pretty much play it perfect so that we can make the argument that the ACC is a gauntlet. This lost an automatic bid, or this lost a, not an automatic bid, of course not. This lost.
You guys are too good for automatic bids.
Yeah, we are. Just like Notre Dame's too good for a conference in football, later date. I honestly think that this was a game that people are going to point to and say, yes, RPI, yes, eye test, yes, everything. ACC does not deserve those at-large bids. Give them to an Ivy League or Big Ten school. And unfortunately, the way that other things played out, I can no longer defend the ACC as the big circle hug. We're a family-friendly podcast of years past. So, yes, it hurts, but you know, due to the RPI, RIP ACC at-large bids. What do you think?
Well, so I'm watching this game right now as we're recording. There's 10 minutes to go in the first quarter. I wasn't able to watch it live. I've watched the highlights, from which I felt like I actually didn't glean that much. So, yeah, I mean, to me, the most important thing coming away from this is Pelisola, as I mentioned, left the game apparently with an injury, but he wasn't the only one. Matt Moore, I believe, scored 2 goals and left the game with an injury. I am very interested in his status for the rest of the year relative to not only the status of his injury, but also what it means for the Cavaliers going forward. So why don't we just talk about the other two games before talking about like the conference at large? Next moment is the moment that you have been – the next topic is the moment you've been waiting all season for on this podcast. Notre Dame 22, Syracuse 6. Nick, you have the floor.
I mean, listen, a lot of people are going to be kind of expecting me to like dance on the grave. You know, Notre Dame's only 3-4. You know, Syracuse might not be as good of a team, you know, as this for great dancing.
You said they're going to the Final Four.
Hold on now. Is this the time for grave dancing? Absolutely. Syracuse should be relegated to Bolivia. Yes, I predicted them to make the Final Four. They shouldn't even
you
make
just
the
beat
final
a Final Four team.
They should be banished from existence. 22 goals to 6. That is the score of a slow pitch Little League softball game, and it doesn't belong in Division I. Syracuse, you're embarrassing yourself. Notre Dame, you can't stop this team. This is the team. This is the win that we needed to steamroll everybody in our path for years to come. We are making the Final Four, not Syracuse. Forget that. Hand up. I was wrong. I thought that these were men playing. No, this was men, and this was boys. And let me assure you of something. 6 foot, 215 pound, number 13, Jake Taylor. He grew up near Wheat Ridge, Colorado. His hometown is listed as Denver, which is Wheat Ridge adjacent. That kid is the spark that this Notre Dame offense needed. It is going to be a completely new team moving forward, led by none other than Colorado kid Jake Taylor. Good for you, popping off with 8 goals. Embarrassing Syracuse wearing that Notre Dame jersey. That's why you go to Notre Dame, so that you can wipe the floor with Syracuse on a national stage. Get out of here with your orange. Gary Gate, take a lap. Everybody else, take a lap. Get on the end line 2 times in a row. Let's go Irish.
So yeah, Jay Taylor, I mean, that third attack spot has been, and truthfully, it's kind of the two attack spots, because even though I think most folks expected Chris Kavanaugh to step in as a starter, he hasn't been consistent. And whether it was Griffin Westland or Jeffrey Riccardelli, and there have been a few other guys that they started, you know, and this actually dates back to last year, because if you remember, it wasn't until Will York got inserted as that lefty attackman that Notre Dame's offense really kind of found their stride. So it kind of it needs to be asked, like, why did it take this long to understand that Jake Taylor was sitting right there? Like, I understand, you know, he missed, I think he put up 3 against Robert Morris and then got injured and missed the year last year. So I'm not saying that, like, there didn't require a reintegration, a rehab, so to speak. But, like, did it need to happen now? Could it not have happened against, you know, if not Georgetown, then Maryland?
Yeah. Well, I think a couple things. One is, you know, with Coach Corrigan and like the way that he approaches offense, I remember there were several times in the season, especially my junior year, when I had just gotten the call to play offense for the first time. And there was probably a 3 or 4 game stretch that I was like, holy moly, not only should I be taken out of the offense, I should probably be cut from the team. I had some pretty bad games. I know, shocking. But he kind of assured me, Nick, like, you don't have to worry about your spot. Get comfortable. We're going to give you a couple games here. And I think that's one of the reasons that we saw the consistency in lineup, even with, you know, oh, Jake Taylor comes out and scores 8. Well, if he didn't, then Coach would have looked like an idiot. Now he looks like a genius. So I think that he lets guys get comfortable. And the criticism, on the other hand, is that, you know, he's forcing his...
He's too slow to react.
Yeah, too slow to react. So, you know, every coach falls in that gray area, too slow to react versus reckless with your lineup. I also think it's interesting to call out, like, in every game except for Maryland, and even in Maryland we scored 9, we've scored 10 or more goals. Like, just looking at the list, you know, 24, 11, 14, 12, 12, 22. Like, yeah, 11 and 12 isn't, you know, as much as you'd like, but historically in Notre Dame, a defensive-minded team, like, if you get to 12 goals, you should probably have a very good realist. Or, sorry, I just misread that. 12 against Michigan and then only 8 against Virginia and 11 against Ohio State. So I didn't think the offensive production was like, oh, we're scoring 3 and 4 goals. I think there were flashes of brilliance that let him have a little bit more leeway in the quote-unquote slow to react. But well, I think also
your point is well taken from the standpoint of, like, you didn't lose to Georgetown because you only scored 11 goals. You lost because you gave up 16. You didn't lose to Maryland. I mean, whatever. It's Maryland. Like, I don't think you're going to make a really dramatic change on the heels of Maryland. You probably lost to Ohio State because you gave up 14. It's not really a justification to make a change offensively. So it really kind of gets down to the point where only putting up 8 against Virginia is the catalyst to actually do something that's dramatic. But to give you an indication of exactly how incredible this is, Jake Taylor is the 4th leading scorer on the team right now.
And I think I saw that he has 11 career goals. And he scored 8 yesterday.
In one game.
Like, you know. But I also think, to your point, like, if I don't even know if you were making this point, maybe you were talking about the inconsistencies with Chris Kavanaugh. If you have the two-headed monster of Pat and Chris Kavanaugh, like, at some point, maybe you start thinking, these are two guys that I want to get extremely comfortable leading the offense together. It's the long play, it's this and that. And the only thing that was missing was that catalyst. Now, is that catalyst going to be, you know, I love a good curveball like this, because who the hell was expecting Jake Taylor to come in, and how much film do you even have? And they probably were like, who is number 13? This kid wasn't even really on the top of the scout, let alone in it at all. So I'm glad that catalysts like this happened, because if I were to criticize Corrigan on that scale, it would be too slow to react as opposed to being reckless, which again is just semantics. But I will say, I hope that this catalyst sparks a little bit of, okay, if we run into a wall again, and if teams figure out Jake Taylor, you have room to be creative and you can figure it out. And also, I mean, going back to the same well, you figure out Syracuse's offense, you do not have to worry about damn near anything. So, again, I'm just really happy. Of course, I'm going to be talking all kinds of smack to my good friend Evan Malloy and all the other Syracuse grads that I know. But I hope that this is the momentum that Notre Dame needed to do two things: to be confident that they can make up that 20% that you were talking about. They just need to be 20% better. Okay, you proved it. You know that you belong. At some point, you start getting in your own head where it's like, shit, are we even a good team? And then two, like, take that confidence and go in with a little bit of swagger. And shit, let's not forget that they held Syracuse to 6 goals too. Just a damn good performance all around.
That being said, to the extent that you're dancing on their grave, they have Albany at Albany on the 7th, and then they host Cornell in the Dome on Monday the 11th. Cornell is pretty beat up and just played a 1-goal game against Dartmouth. It is very realistic that Syracuse is going to be 6-5 heading to North Carolina, who we just saw lay an absolute egg against Duke, which we're about to get to. This is a team that absolutely can be 7-5 with Virginia and Notre Dame coming to town, which at worst puts them at 7-7. Now, what does it mean relative to their NCAA tournament resume? Like, what do wins over Duke, Cornell, and Carolina get you in that situation? I don't know. All I'm saying is that the path to a not unsuccessful season for the Orange is still available. Like, they are not 6 feet underground, to utilize an Undertaker metaphor on a WrestleMania night.
Yeah. And let me say, even though I just had really fun dancing grave and said that, no, of course they're not going to make the Final Four, they're a dump, I would be more worried about playing Syracuse than, like, I don't want to say an Ivy League, you know, I don't know. But I just don't get how teams can be so good and so bad in the span of 2 weeks. Like, what the hell is going on?
Well, that's a perfect segue to talk about. So a lot was made of the fact that I believe Syracuse got to Notre Dame at 1 a.m. on Saturday morning. Well, the same thing happened to Duke when they went to Syracuse last week and lost 14-10 in the Dome. So then the Blue Devils turn around and put a 15-6 win on the Tar Heels in front of a alumni celebration in Chapel Hill at Dorrance Field in a game that I believe they led like 10-1. I mean, the ineptitude or ineffectiveness of the Carolina offense was really remarkable. And on the other hand, Brennan O'Neill scored 7 goals. So I'm not sure where to attack this from, because on the one hand, what's wrong with Carolina? Or were they always this and we just didn't really know because of the status or strength of their schedule? And on the other hand, why doesn't Brandon O'Neill score 7 goals every game?
I have been wondering that same thing myself. And my best guess is at some point, like, you know, you take a peek at, you know, Duke's schedule with losses to Jacksonville, Penn, Loyola, and Syracuse, which, first off, they've played a bananas amount of games. Like, it really does blow yes. my mind. But, like, I think at some point you kind of have to take a peek at the schedule, look at who you've lost to. You don't really have too big of a marquee win, and you have some bad losses. And I think a little bit comes down to two things. One, like, comfortability with your teammates. Obviously, you just grow throughout the season. But a guy like Brandon O'Neill just kind of needs to recognize that he can just take over games, and that, to an extent, not saying this with 100% certainty, he can't take a bad shot because his stick skills and talent level kind of warrant that if someone else were to take that shot, not a good idea. But with him, kind of have a day. It really doesn't matter a whole hell of a lot. So I hope that he's starting to realize just how talented he is, and he's not waiting for the entire team to get going. He's just kind of saying, okay, I am going to do this, even though his shooting percentage is, from what I'm seeing right here, only around 32%. But his shots on goal at 59%. I'll take that any day of the week over half the other guys. So I think that Brennan O'Neill is going to just stop dicking around and saying, okay, that preseason, middle of the season slump is over, and now I get to do what I want.
So on the other hand, North Carolina, which is a team that has been, in my opinion, far too reliant on Chris Gray to this point in the season, and you would expect that type of dynamic to evolve as some of their young offensive players, particularly some of their young middies, got more comfortable, got more experience, etc. You've been an upperclassman on a good team. What do you say about specifically freshmen, but whatever, just to make it a more interesting conversation, freshmen and sophomores getting their first playing time? What's the difference between what you can reasonably expect out of them in game 1, 2, and 3 versus game 6, 7, 8, 9?
A lot of it comes down to the comfortableness in creativity. And what I mean by that is, so those, you know, like when you're a senior and the freshman's getting his first nod, like a lot of what you'll say to him, because if he's getting a nod, he's obviously a damn good player. Very few people can go to a program and play, let alone succeed at the freshman sophomore level, let alone be an offensive contributor. So in those first couple games, you get to take them aside and go, hey, you know why you're on this offense. You know what your role is. Like for Sergio Perkovic as a freshman, it was like, dude, just get the ball and throw absolute piss missiles at the cage. You know why you're out there on the field. And then as it progresses and they get comfortable doing what they are meant to do, Sergio Perkovic shooting, Matt Kavanaugh is a little bit of a different example because he kind of did it all right from the start. But whether you're a Dodger, like when I got my first nod as a sophomore on offense, it was like, Nick, dodge hard and then pass the ball. That's why you're here. Okay, perfect. And then as it progresses, those conversations go from stay in your lane to you know what you can do. Now go and do it. Nick, you can dodge, but the scout is saying that you might not be able to shoot it. We know you can shoot it. Take that shot. And it lets them get a little bit more comfortable. Now, the double-edged sword of that is sometimes they can overextend themselves and get too comfortable trying things that they might not be able to execute at a high-level Division I level, to repeat that word, levels by Avicii. But I always think find that might be what we saw from Carolina is, oh, I'm comfortable, now I can do this. And then it's like, okay, now we have to slow our roll and go back to why you're on the field in the first place.
So despite what many of our listeners may believe justifiably, we are not an ACC lacrosse podcast. And we had an incredible game in the Ivy League with Yale emerging as 12-11 overtime victors over Penn. Nick, this is a surprise. Why don't we go ahead and add somebody who is live in attendance at the game?
Oh, God.
You ready?
Yeah. You keep surprising me with guests.
And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Dan Arestia, a very new voter to the Inside Lacrosse media poll. I didn't know that. Nick is going to be so sour to hear that because he's not yet a voter.
Oh, okay. Wait, how could? All right, just let me know how big of a check it is to get on that committee. But
it's anyway. Not that big. I picked a heck of a week to start voting too.
No doubt.
Picked a hell of a week to stop sniffing glue.
So Dan, you were in attendance at Reese Stadium for Yale's win over Penn in overtime. All these teams do is play great games. What was the vibe like in the arena?
It was pretty intense, I'll be honest. I went with my brother because he's a Penn alum. He was in the area, so we went up to watch the game. And I didn't even know till I got there, but it was Cy Lacrosse Fieldhouse Dedication Day. And like the women had just beaten Brown, and there was a crowd left over from that. And then if you've ever been to a Yale game at Reese Stadium, you know they come out. They used to come out from by the field house. Now they come out by the Cy Lacrosse field house there. But their thing is that they come out as the other team's already warming up, and they run right across the midfield line in a lines of two by two line, and they just do some talking. And that's always been like something they do. And Penn was up for it. There was like pro wrestling level pointing and jawing back and forth. And this was like 40 minutes till game time. So there was some intensity definitely on the field and definitely in the stands. People were fired up for this game.
You know what I hate is Ivy League nerds that talk a bunch of shit, because that's been Yale's MO. I played Yale once and I had never heard the shit come out of their mouth. They called us a bunch of rich private school white boys, and I was flabbergasted. So that's just my two cents on Yale. But looking at the box score, Yale had, I mean, way more contributors than Penn. Did Yale's balance come into play, and did Penn's, I don't want to say, lack of diversity in distributing the points throughout their offense, but what was the biggest reason that you saw Yale able to come away with it?
I kind of said afterwards, I really don't think Penn played a very clean game. I don't want to take anything away from Yale because they're definitely good enough to win that game, even if Penn does play well. But, Penn had 20 plus turnovers and some of them in really, really big spots. I mean, Nick Ramsey was really solid for Yale all day at the faceoff X. And I think he only won a little north of 50%. So it didn't seem like it came through in the box score, but you know, to watch the game, it felt like every big one he was coming up with. But you know, like late in the fourth quarter, I think Zusi finally won one for Penn, and you know, BJ Ferrer wins the ground ball and then just sails the transfer pass to the attackman and it goes out of bounds. And there were like consecutive possessions where that kind of thing was happening for Penn. And just late in the game against a team as good as Yale, who's going to force some turnovers anyway, you know, that's going to be a factor. You know, Yale's ride was really on point all day, which has been a hallmark of them for years. So, you know, I think Yale is good enough to win that game. Like I said, I think Penn had a big advantage through the midfield in that I thought Hanley was overpowering at times, but, you know, ran himself into trouble at times. And, you know, the same kind of with Shipley was able to shake his man plenty of times, but then just kind of just the pass coming off the dodge wasn't on point. So, you know, for Yale, I think it was, like you said, kind of a balanced day where, you know, it didn't seem like guys like Brandow were like taking the game over or Leo Johnson wasn't doing a ton of ball carrying. It was definitely a spread effort from their offense.
Not to pander by backing up my co-host, but I would agree with your premise, Nick, from the standpoint of, and this was kind of the theme of the story.
I'm a genius. I should vote.
This was the theme of the story that I wrote about the game, which is that so Yale has four freshmen among their top six offensive players right now, and like six in their top nine. So it's pretty remarkable how much they're relying on Leo Johnson, who's been a starting attackman since the beginning of the season, Chris Lyons, who was recently asserted for Will Cabrera as the third starter to attack. And, you know, Cabrera is a catch-and-shoot finisher. Lyons has added a lot of dynamic dodging ability to that group. And then, you know, Christian Krop, who was injured against RIT. Dan, you reported that. He's back, but he's not at his, you know, peak level. Logan Solberg has been out. So what we expected to be a Yale first midfield line of Tevlin, Krop, Hackler, who's, you know, struggled to produce a little bit. You know, we saw Johnny Kibe, a freshman from Syracuse, get his first start. Brad Sharp was the most productive midfielder with 2-1. But then Max Krevsky and Carson Kuhl both got goals. So they went really deep in terms of that freshman contributor. And there are actually a couple more that they could potentially be relying on over the course of the next couple of weeks. Whereas I think, Dan, your point is also really spot on. Penn's ability to win this game was going to emanate from their midfield dodgers being unable to be guarded. And it was particularly Hanley and Shipley. I mean, those two have been really good all year long. I felt like Yale's three close defensemen played their best game of the season. And I don't think that they had played particularly well up to this point. And it wasn't to say that, like, you know, first of all, Dylan Gurgar had an okay game. Not a great game, but an okay game. Cam Rubin absolutely came alive down the stretch. I mean, he had three goals from in the last 20 minutes, including the game tying goal. But it was, again, you hit the nail on the head with respect to Ramsey. Like, you know, he won a couple faceoffs late. I mean, ultimately, the story of this game is that Yale should have won it going away on the basis of the three-goal stretch that they reeled off in the early part of the third quarter. But after that, their offense went completely cold. Penn kind of struggled to take advantage of how cold Yale's offense was. Like, if they had been playing as well offensively as they did against Princeton, like, they would have closed that gap in 5 minutes. Instead, it took, like, 20. And as a result, they tied the game with 4 minutes to go. They had one shot to go ahead, didn't convert. I think it was the turnover that you referenced. And then Yale basically had the ball for the last 2.5 minutes, didn't get a good look, but then won the faceoff in overtime, and it was a freshman turning the corner, and that's what kind of put the game away. So it's just interesting to me from the standpoint of the direction that these two teams are heading, because I think coming in, it was true and comparatively easy to say that Penn was better. But I do think that Yale, because of how much youth they're playing, is going to get more better, is going to improve at a faster rate over the course of the season, even relative not just to Penn, but also Cornell, Princeton, and Harvard. Harvard obviously playing a ton of freshmen defensively, so maybe not to take that away. I just think that, you know, Yale's a step ahead on the basis of the competition they played so far this year. So, yeah, I guess that was just my assessment of the game. The question that I would have for you is, why do these two teams play such good games? And how much does it have to do with the fact that Penn met them at the midline 40 minutes before the game to go chin-to-chin with them from a trash-talking perspective?
Yeah, I think Penn-Yale is a legitimate rivalry. It doesn't really seem like one, and like it doesn't have the basics or the basis that other rivalries have, and that there's not like a big geographic connection or, you know, traditional sort of rivalry there between the two locations. They don't have like, you know, some ugly history or something, or, you know, there's nothing that's like where you would say, all right, these schools just don't like each other. But I think they honestly just don't like each other. You know, like I said, I went with my brother and he was like, you know, my brother played at Penn and he was saying, he's like, yeah, like Princeton is like the rivalry game, air quotes. He's like, but man, we hated Yale. We just wanted to beat the hell out of Yale. So I think there's like legitimate rivalry between these two schools. You know, and I would agree with kind of the assessment of Yale, and particular with Lions, you know, just kind of to go back to that a little bit. I think early in the year, as I watched Yale, I know some other people I was talking to watching Yale, the impression we got was like, you know, Brandow is obviously great. Leo Johnson looks awesome. He's able to run by people, but man, what are they going to do in the midfield? How are they, what happens if the other team can match up with those two guys and they just can't run by anybody? And I think the, you know, the freshmen that you mentioned, Terry, are Yale's answer kind of to that question, right? We needed to find some people who can run by somebody and put them on the field, who can win some individual matchups. And Lions can clearly do that. He just did it to win a game in overtime. But they're finding some guys, some dodging depth, I think, to add to that attack. So it doesn't always have to be kind of early offense driven by the attack, or let these two, you know, superstars that we have, you know, break their man down for us. But they're getting it from other places. And when you look at some of the best teams in the country right now, that's what their offenses look like, is that there's these deep offenses that can beat you with a lot of guys, whether it's obviously Maryland and a tier on their own, but even watching Rutgers tonight, like there's just a lot of guys on the field who can run by somebody or can hurt you. And Yale is starting to find, I think, those personnel groupings a little more than they had early in the year.
I love the non-rival rival. Because everybody that always talked to me, they'd be like, oh, who do you hate more, Duke or Denver? And I'm like, good question, UNC. I want to slide high and late to all of them. So I kind of like here, maybe we need to do a series on like what teams actually hate each other the most versus what are like the well-known rivalries. I think that would be some fascinating stuff. And then Dan, maybe not 100% relevant to this game, but also very relevant. Ivy League or ACC, who's better across the board?
That's kind of a tough question. That's a really, I mean,
you have to answer it.
I am going to take top to bottom. I think I'm going to take the Ivy League.
Unbelievable. Get him off this pod. And this guy votes. Are you kidding me? And this guy votes.
Yeah. You tell me when the poll comes out tomorrow, and I don't do the whole thing, but see how many of the Ivy Leagues are in the top 10 and see how many of the ACC are.
Yeah, well, wait until the post-game poll comes out and see where Dan Arestia ranks.
Going to be right below Culver.
I just have one more thing to say about this game, which is that a little bit to your Brandow point, Brandon Lavelle is a really good defenseman. He guarded him. And Matt Brandow did not have nearly the success that he did being guarded by Pace Billings at Princeton, who is one of three starting defensemen for the Tigers, with George Bond and Ben Finley, the other two, that received midseason All-America votes. So Brandon Lavelle, don't sleep on him, is my last point. We've got one more game.
Defense was great.
We've got one more game that we're going to talk about. It was the craziest game of an otherwise crazy weekend. So High Point went to Jacksonville. It was the Dolphins' first meaningful game, no offense to their opponents, over the course of the last 3 weeks since their loss to Utah. The Panthers and the Dolphins have played a really high-quality series. High Point's won 9 of the 12 meetings. They very memorably lost in the 2019 SoCon semifinals. That was the year that they had wins over Duke and Virginia and didn't qualify for the NCAA tournament. But they had beaten Jacksonville 3 times on the trot heading into this one. They jumped out to a 3-goal lead. And talking to John Galloway afterward, he was particularly pleased with his team's ability to overcome 2 3-goal runs and overcome the fact that Max Walbaum and Jack Dolan were limited to a combined 3 assists. And they were able to do that because Ethan LeMond, a redshirt freshman midfielder, and Jeremy Winston, a redshirt senior midfielder, no, fifth-year midfielder, combined for 9 goals. But that's not just what made this game crazy, particularly when you consider the conditions under which those two guys did, which I wrote about in the game story. But also, there were 12 penalties in the second half and a 67-minute lightning delay. So about as crazy as it comes, So the lightning delay occurred with 3 minutes and 22 seconds left in the fourth quarter when it was a, I believe, 1-goal game. Maybe it was a 2-goal game. Either way, it was very close. And there were 2 penalties after that. So both teams had a man-up opportunity. An absolutely insane game in which Jacksonville comes out on top, 14-13. They moved to, I believe, 8-2 on the year. They've got Richmond coming up, who obviously are coming off of a win over Virginia. It was an incredible showing for the Dolphins, who really needed it in order to just bolster, right? Like, not establish themselves, but bolster themselves as a top-10 team. Dan, what did this win do for you relative to the notion of Jacksonville is a bona fide top 10 team, or they're a pretender who has a Super Bowl Sunday win over Duke when they were playing their 4th game in 9 days?
I think I'm still a believer in Jacksonville. I think that might be because I probably rate High Point maybe a little better than some others. I think High Point's pretty good. I was excited to kind of watch this one, and I think Jacksonville's win over Denver is still, a solid one. And I guess for them, they've got a couple chances to, really one chance to try and notch one more, I guess you would call it a quality win the rest of the way. And that they have the UVA defeating Richmond Spiders on their schedule next week. But after that, it's VMI, Hampton, and Mercer. So, I think Jacksonville's kind of shown you who they are at this point, and you're not going to learn a whole lot more about them, I think, barring something miraculous and them dropping one of those games. But, I think they're legit. I really am a believer in Waldbaum as well. I had dubbed this game the Thick Attackman Bowl, and Waldbaum did actually not do a ton in this game. Neither did Asher Nolting, but, well.
How did that affect your big board?
I still have Waldbaum as a player to watch.
He's got another year. We don't know whether he's going to take it, but he could come back for another year at Jacksonville if he wanted to.
Wait, where is
there are guys, not to like get too off topic, but there are guys who I've talked to who have another year and are considering foregoing their extra year to come out, depending on the position they play, if they 100%. See a chance to actually make like a roster and play.
I'm not trying to discredit the opportunity to play PLL. I'm just saying that there are a lot of college lacrosse players who are pretty sick of playing college lacrosse right now.
That's also true. I don't think I would move Jacksonville too much in the poll. I think they were, somewhere in between the 10 to 13 range. That's probably where I'll still have them. I don't think it's not like I'm not going to drop Virginia behind them or anything like that. I think they're still a good team though. I think their quality wins are still quality. I think Duke's a good win for anybody that can manage to get one. I'm definitely a believer in the Dolphins.
Nick, where are you going to vote Jacksonville in your poll this week?
Yeah, well, maybe I just don't even have a poll because no one even gives me serious chances. Maybe I'm just waiting for a chance. First off, where's Max Waldbaum from originally?
He's from Denver, Colorado.
You're damn right. Denver, Colorado, home of the Thick Boys. The one thing that I can't get over is their loss to Hopkins, because I am not impressed with Hopkins. I've been kind of a hater, even though I really have a lot of respect for the coaching staff and I like them. Other than that, like, a loss to Utah, I don't think is too bad. I think everybody has the right to slip up a little bit, but I can't get over granted it was in early February. I would have them probably in the 10 to 12 range.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, with Richmond coming up, if they beat Richmond, then, you know, I would almost put more on that, where it's like I want to have an excuse to put them at, like, you know, seven, like six or seven.
Yeah.
But I just don't see that right now. So that's where, you know, my mature point of view is coming from. Second off, Galloway's a goddamn lunatic to coach against. I love it. I'm not surprised that they won coming out of a lightning delay. Wouldn't even be surprised if he manufactured that with his pure electricity on the sideline. And as a fan, I think one of the interesting things, I was just talking about this with Richmond, but I think that this was like a matchup of the two teams that could really shake up and people use as a talking point for parity for the next 5 years. I really think the trajectory of High Point and Jacksonville alongside Richmond, like, those are the three teams, really beautiful campuses, good facilities, good locations. They're starting to get some big wins. They're starting to make some buzz. And I really wouldn't be surprised if we see one of those teams become a top 10 staple, in the next couple years.
Do you think the fact that they filmed AEW exclusively in Jacksonville during the COVID pandemic is an asset or a disadvantage for the program?
What's AEW?
It's the fake WWE.
That, then bad, because WWE is super sick, and AEW, I don't even know what it is. But they probably weren't even trying to film wrestling. They were probably just pointing a camera and
at, like, some in the streets of Jacksonville, and just, it's like Cops.
Yeah, no, that wasn't AEW. That was Cops in Florida, Terry.
Dan, we talked about Virginia Richmond. We talked about Notre Dame, Syracuse. We talked about Duke, Carolina before you joined. Any other observations from the weekend? I mean, you can obviously weigh in on the ACC's debacle if you want, but you're probably going to struggle to say anything that hasn't already been said.
Well, I would say, you know, I think an interesting scoreline was 10-9 Army over Bucknell. I think that game, that's another one of, like, the sneaky, this might actually be a rivalry that nobody realizes is a rivalry game.
Everybody hates Bucknell, so yes, that's probably it.
So, you know, I think that scoreline was interesting. I always hope we're going to – every week I check the lineup to hope to see Marcus Hudgens, and we still haven't. But, I thought Army would win that game by a lot more than they did. I didn't think Bucknell would have any answer for Nick Turn, but, 10-9 was what it was. And then the only other close game that I was surprised was close was Harvard and Colgate. I thought Harvard would crush that game. I thought they'd put up, 15 goals and run all over Colgate. But them only managing seven was a surprise to me. Not that they held Colgate to six. I just thought Harvard would be able to put up more than they did. Staying in the Ivy League, Dartmouth staying right there with Cornell. Daniel Hanks, I think, was a monster in that game. So, I mean, Dartmouth's had some close ones this year and has been kind of an all-over-the-map kind of team. But, it's making my case for the Ivy League again. If they're the worst team in the Ivy League and they're a one-goal loser to Cornell, like, they're a team that can just kind of show up and hang with anybody. So I think another good showing for them this weekend.
Nick, do you have anything to say for your friends at Harvard in terms of their inability to blow out Colgate?
No, I was in Boston and I went to the Merrimack game and all of this shit that they were talking about, like, oh, you know, you're in Boston, you're not even coming to the game, blah, blah, blah. I don't have any defense of Harvard. maybe just realize that, I have a girlfriend and, you guys all have wives. And so I'm still doing fun stuff.
How was the Merrimack game?
Shut up. How was what?
How was the Merrimack game?
It was good. The parents certainly get after it. I was, slated to call it. It was not up to, I really just thought that
your lofty standards.
Yeah, I was gonna say up to my standards, but with how I acted at the tailgate, I don't think anything is up to anybody's standards anymore. You know, I'll leave it at they call it the bed of a truck for a reason. How was I supposed to know? So, you know, piece that together. And then final point, Dan, I did my favorite thing, but my least favorite thing when it's done to me to you. I made zero predictions about this weekend's games, and all I did was chirp you for picking Syracuse. So
I said, and I stand by, if I had known Syracuse was going to wear those uniforms, I wouldn't have gone anywhere near Syracuse plus 2.5. Wouldn't have even thought about it.
Well, I don't know why they just – you have – the template, control C, control V. If you want to get crazy, do one of your stupid porthole mesh things. Why do they have to do this? I don't get it.
There's some weird uniform choices among top dudes'
fashion decisions, but Jesus.
Everything about that game was wrong for Syracuse. So they showed up at 1 in the morning with bad uniforms. Like that, there couldn't have been worse mojo for them in that game.
Okay. But if we're talking about vibes yielding outcomes, then how is it that Hopkins meets Guy Fieri on a Saturday night and it doesn't turn into a win? I mean, that's enough to make you give up on the entire idea altogether.
No, well, it just means that Hopkins is more of a dumpster fire than we thought, and their ability to be a dumpster fire out trumps damn near anybody's ability to be cool. Because if you call in the big guns and get Guy Fieri there, then, you know, maybe just mail it in and, you know, just don't show up to the next game. Also, shout out to the Cancun Airport's Guy Fieri Bar and Grill. You make fantastic wings. The blue cheese sauce is delightful.
So, you know how people are calling for a permanent location for the Final Four? I think Flavortown is the absolute spot.
Yeah.
Shut up. I can't believe I just fell for that. I was like, oh, what is it going to be? And then, wow. I need to go
Dan,
to bed.
Any final thoughts?
I was right there. Hook, line, and sinker. Yeah, I mean, another fun week. This is like that first Saturday.
No. It wasn't another fun week. It was the funnest week. I know funnest isn't a word. This was the funnest week of college across for sure.
Yeah. Like this, when the calendar flips to April and you get the first Saturday looks like that one, we're just like, you start looking for the game to watch and there just aren't enough screens in Best Buy to put them all on. You know, I had a ton of fun with the games this weekend. I wish there were more today. You know, I wish there was a little
come on,
more Sunday.
Spread us out.
Yeah, I can't. I'm trying to watch all these games. Like, let me do it. Let me watch your team play. I want to watch you.
Schedule a game for noon on Saturday with 22 other games. Maryland-Michigan should have been at noon on Sunday.
That would have been great. That would have been right up my schedule. I had the kids at soccer, come home, little Maryland-Michigan. That would have been perfect. And then shout out to Rutgers-Hopkins for letting me flip over to the UConn game earlier than I wanted to. That game was very clear how that was going very early.
And all right, fellas. Thank you for joining us on the tailgate. As always, Nick, it was great to hear from you. Dan, congratulations on your vote. I can't wait for you to lord it over Nick, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, guys.
Love you guys. Love you, Dan.
Love you, Nick.
Love you, Terry.
Love you, Nick. Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.